not going to begin. Can you hear me across the floor? I hate to shout, I'm by nature a very quiet, retiring person. I don't know if you saw the title of this. It's I Am Curious, Fight. That's really a dirty trick. In case you don't know, I Am Curious Yellow is a dirty movie. And I gave this presentation a few weeks ago, and I wanted to get out some people who I thought might not come if I was honest about what the topic was. So I tried to seduce them in. It's not really going to be about sexy movies at all.
I haven't
seen the movie. A more accurate title would be I Am Curious, Whitey. I want to make you curious tonight, if you aren't already, about what this new group of people in our society is talking about. I mean these fierce talking, fierce looking breed of black militants who are making so much racket, who are working, some of them in the slums of our large cities, and others are found in our colleges, and now at our church conventions. What are these people after? Many whites are curious, and besides being curious, I found that many white people are extremely troubled, afraid, frustrated, because this is a turn they hadn't expected, and sometimes angry, and sometimes hurt, too. So for a person, there are many white people who have long supported the NAACP and who have felt themselves to be thoroughgoing civil rights people, and all of a sudden they're called honkies, and it hurts. And probably the main reason why so many white people, I mean liberal white people, when I say liberal, now I mean a white person who has always believed and said that racial discrimination, racial prejudice in every form is bad, we must work to get rid of it. The reason these people are so troubled and hurt and frustrated, I think, is because they say we've made a great deal of progress in race relations in the last few years, last 15 years, or 10 years, or 5 years. And when you look at the record, it certainly seems true, we have. Just think back before 1954 and how the racial situation has changed since then for the better. Today in this country, Negroes are almost totally free of legal discrimination. Where discrimination exists, it is a violation of law. They are getting into more of the better jobs. You see Negroes on TV. Julia's got her own show, and every little chorus that appears, and it's got a black girl here and a black man back there. You see them in department stores now. You see them in management positions. In fact, many corporations are very eagerly seeking Negroes, and not just for a show. They don't always put them in positions where everybody can see that they have Negroes. They're really eager to obtain some. Competing, not only on colleges, of course. If you're black today and interested in teaching school, you can name your own price. And another thing, blacks today are very able to influence legislation. Some people say, a lot of people up here who've talked to me about it, are quite convinced that black people today are over-influencing legislation. So that today we're witnessing a lot of discrimination in favor of Negroes. And somebody in here just the other day or night, I don't remember when it was, said, I think the law should be enforced equally against all people. And his point was that it's not being enforced against Negroes, that they're allowed to disobey laws that white people couldn't disobey and get away with it. I think it is true that we have made more progress toward equality and justice for Negroes in the last 10 years than we made in the previous 100. And nonetheless, and this is the source of the frustration, that in the last 4, 5, 6 years, Negroes have been doing things that they never did before. They've been rioting, burning, looting in our cities. they're referring to policemen, all policemen, as pigs. Some of them refer seemingly to all white people as pigs. They're joining what looks like hate groups, groups that call white men devils. They're making demands. They're not asking, they're demanding, and they're saying these aren't negotiable. And interestingly, they're making these demands largely on their friends, the groups that have in the past acted very very much on behalf of the Negroes. I mean, they tend to make demands on the liberal churches and on the colleges and universities, which have been the leaders in the struggle against racial discrimination. They are even rejecting the help of white people. The famous SNCC purge, where Stokely Carmichael suddenly announced to white people who were in SNCC that either they should get to the back and take orders from blacks or get out. Well, why? And beyond the question of why, what's going to happen? What's going to emerge from all of this? I think that we must admit that if the black militants continue to grow in strength, and I know, Paul, you had some doubts about whether their strength is growing, and maybe it is slowing down, but I don't know. I have a feeling that it is temporarily halted, but that it's going to resume. The curve of growth will resume. But in any event, if the black militant cause continues to grow at any rate like that at which it has grown in the last 3 or 4 years, we're going to be in serious trouble. Because 10% of the population, you might say, can't overthrow a government supported by the other 90%. That may be true. But in the process of attempting to overthrow it, they are capable of destroying our civilization and culture. Guerrilla warfare is very hard to suppress. It's expensive in lives and property. And I think, as a college professor, that they are very close today to destroying our colleges and universities. They are certainly forcing them to make changes which, don't seem to square very well with traditions of liberal education and academic freedom. And many of them say, well, we don't care. We'll just pull the whole thing down if we don't get what we want. Their demands, the demands that they make upon faculties and administrations of colleges seem often to be terribly unrealistic and unreasonable and separatist, you know. We worked for years to get the white fraternities to admit Negroes. And finally, you know, we get, and then the Negroes come along and demand a black fraternity. It all seems so separatist and reverse racism and anti-intellectual and illiberal, and the colleges seem peculiarly powerless against them. Well, now, some people say, and I've heard it here, so I'm sure there's some among you who said this and felt this way, well, we've got to start enforcing the law. Well, that's certainly one alternative. But the cost, if we go this route, if we try to deal with the black militants by enforcing the law, and only that, the cost is going to be extremely heavy. And it may not even work, because in the first place, as I said, guerrilla warfare is hard to put down. And this isn't a matter of isolated violations of the law. It's a matter of an organized, open, flagrant violation of the law, which verges on rebellion. And another thing, Harvard demonstrated it very clearly this year, if we attempt to enforce the law against what we think are unreasonable actions by blacks, and we don't do it very, very carefully, we will radicalize a lot of potential sympathizers, and we'll find ourselves really the minority trying to enforce the law against the majority. At Harvard, the people, the SDS people, who in support of black demands, originally started the demonstration. They were quite small, but when the police went in and used excessive force in removing these SDS people from the building, then the campus was radicalized, and the majority of the Harvard student body set itself up against the administration. Moreover, I am certain that the suppression of internal revolt is quite capable of bringing on a police state. The innocent as well as the guilty are going to be harassed. And it isn't going to be just innocent Negroes, also innocent whites. I have a friend who got picked up in this net because he had, simply he'd been a character witness for a SNCC leader in Dallas. He was harassed by the police, and it cost him, one instance of harassment cost him $1,200. He was arrested in the middle of the night on a completely trumped up charge of possession of marijuana. They didn't care that he was trumped up because he had to post bail. He had to hire a lawyer, and he had to hire a detective to accumulate evidence to prove he was innocent. The total bill came to $1,200. Now, the question that bothers me, and I think bothers many of you, is are we compelled to stand by and see this country's grand experiment? And I think it is a grand experiment. I'm a great lover of America for all its vices. I think its virtues are extraordinary. And I don't believe this is boasting, because I have nothing to do with it. But I am extremely grateful for the heritage that I have received. From people like the Puritans, who aren't as black as they are painted, as somebody said there, and the founding fathers, of whom I make spot on the 4th of July, but whom I revere, people like Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln, and the great American tradition, which, you know, we haven't always honored, but which we've always had a guilty conscience about not honoring, of equality and justice and freedom. And plus, of course, our prosperity, is all of this to go down the drain in the face of this new internal challenge? What's happening? Why? What do the black militants want? I am curious, white. Well, our curiosity need not go unsatisfied, because they've told us, and they're still telling us in print, why they're angry, what they want, and what they want of us. Now, maybe we shouldn't grant it. Maybe they're all wrong. Or maybe they're more wrong than they are right. Or maybe their ends are good, but their means have to be rejected. Now, there are many possibilities, and I want you to reflect on them. But in order to decide among these possibilities, we must at least know the situation to which we're responding. And I think that there's a great deal of misunderstanding and ignorance among white people about what is really going on. To understand the black militants, it is first of all necessary to understand the extent of their disillusionment with integration. That's the beginning. If you don't understand that, then you've thrown away the key. And this, of course, is the hardest thing for the white liberal to grasp, isn't it? Because the white liberal is an integrationist. This is the source of his hurt and his frustration and his anger. I mean, we say, isn't integration what they've always wanted? Isn't this what I have always fought for? Isn't this the goal that makes it worthwhile? The brotherhood of man, the fatherhood of God? Isn't this the Christian ideal, the democratic ideal? They're throwing this out, then what makes the struggle worth participating in? The black militant says, we thought we wanted it. We thought we wanted integration, but now we know better. He says that integration is not possible in our society. Why not? Because, he says, this is a fundamentally racist society. White people are racists because their culture is racist, and their culture is racist because they are racists, and it's not going to change, at least not unless something absolutely revolutionary occurs. The cost, moreover, of striving for integration, says the black militant, is crippling to the Negro. It cripples him psychologically. And now we have to really make an effort to put ourselves in the shoes of a black man. The rule of integration has always been, if you prove yourself as an individual human being, then we will accept you into our society on the same terms that we accept everybody else. So, the Negro believes this, and he goes to school, he goes to college, he gets a PhD, he learns to talk like white folks talk, where you listen to him over the telephone and you say, "My, George, just, you know, you can't even tell you're talking to a Negro." And he dresses like white people dress. He doesn't wear a hat, you know, like they do. And he doesn't just, you know, he's just like all of us. And so he's going to be accepted. And we're of course all very proud to know him. In fact, one Negro goes a long way here. You'd be surprised how many people count him as one of their very best friends. And wouldn't care if their daughter married him either. They say, I mean, these Negroes, of course, are very, very useful in Lutheran churches. So what have I said? That if a Negro will work hard, improve himself, and become like a white man, then he can enter into the land flowing with milk and honey. But it's not true, because tomorrow he will go into a restaurant and, you know, what Malcolm X told this college professor, PhD Negro, who was arguing with him, he said, "Do you know what they call a PhD who's a brain surgeon and who's black?" Guy said, "No, he's nigger." And that's true. It's always subject to this possibility, and it happens a lot more than we realize. What is the psychological effect on a man who's poured everything he's got into making it, who has been told, "Now you do 1, 2, 3, and 4, and you'll be in," and he did 1, 2, 3, and 4, and in order to do it, it was a lot harder for him than it was for other people. And then we change the rules, unpredictable. And of course, you know, we always apologize. We're terribly sorry about that. When Ralph Bunche is refused a hotel room, all America weeps for shame. But somehow, I don't think that weeping for shame has quite the right effect on Ralph Bunche. I said it's psychologically crippling. It's psychologically crippling in other ways, too, because one of the things that we tell the Negro is you also should look like a white man. For years, black parents have told their children that white standards of beauty are the right standards of beauty. Any of you ever seen Ebony magazine? Or any or Jet? Any of these little magazines that, you know, contain a little cheesecake now and then? Look at the good-looking girl. Now, it's changing. It's changing. But they were always Negro girls who looked like whites. Good, because the white standards of beauty were the proper standards of beauty. A little Negro kid was told from small on up that he was ugly because he was black, because he had kinky hair, because he had thick lips, basically these things. And he grew up ashamed of what he was. And why do you suppose Negro men for years put this lie on their hair and gotten these processes? You've all seen Negro men, I'm sure, walking around with handkerchiefs over their heads, haven't you? Why do you know why they wear those? It's to preserve the process, the conch. It's a very painful thing to get your hair straightened. And once you've gone through that pain, you want it to last as long as possible. So you go out on your date with your hair nice and straight like a white man's, and then in order to keep it that way, as soon as you're through the date, you plaster that handkerchief on there, try to keep her straight so it doesn't kick up again. You've seen little black girls, 5, 6 years old, with their hair in 3 pigtails sticking out here. Imagine how painful that was. Their mother took that brush and just pulled and pulled and got that hair just so that... Because otherwise it'd just be a kinky mess up there, you know, and that's bad. What does it mean to a person that even his hair is wrong? His hair's got to look like somebody else's hair. what has happened to a person who buys a skin bleacher? Well, we've done it to them. We've had the cooperation of the Negroes. Negro parents have told their kids, have repeated the story, that they are black and ugly because of the sin of Ham.
No, they're brown. This used to be very important to say, I'm brown rather than black, you know. But now they're saying I'm black.
Yeah.
And black
yeah.
is beautiful.
Well, sure. They used to be themselves very, very color conscious. That's a fact, you know. In fact, this was a source. I've had people tell me, listen, don't tell me color discrimination is found only among whites. Do you know that the Negroes themselves discriminate on the basis of color? I know it. But where did they get that idea? Where did they get the idea that to be light-skinned, a light-skinned Negro is better than to be a dark-skinned Negro? They have grown up in a society in which white is beautiful. White features are beautiful. White hair is beautiful. And where they were continually being told from all sorts of directions that in order to make it, they had to look like a white, talk like a white, think like a white, be a white. Moreover, it's socially crippling to try to struggle for integration, because when the Negro struggled for integration, he always came with his hat in his hand. Please, will you give us what your Constitution says we're entitled to? Please. And we might sat back and felt so proud of ourselves when we gave the Negro, we just gave him what he already owned, but what we had first deprived him of. Little children are so revelatory in this. You know, it isn't enough for a, you know, say there's a quarter sitting around somewhere, and Eric says, that's mine, and Margo, I'm just making these names up. Margo says, it's mine, and so finally Eric says, all right, it's really mine, but you can have it. And Margo says, no, it's mine. Eric says, I'm saying you can have it, even though it's mine. We don't want to be given that which we feel is ours. And when we have to come continually and beg for that which is by right ours, this is crippling. And the Negroes as a group have been socially crippled by the fight for integration. I'm just going to ask you, I don't want to take too much longer. I want to ask you now, honestly, to search your own experience, your own innermost thoughts and reactions. See if you don't agree that our society is not just a society which practices racial discrimination, but it is a fundamentally racist society. I want you to see if you don't agree that you are fundamentally a racist. I am. Blackness jars us. And I mean it jars the liberal, integrationist, white person. Because we have drawn up within ourselves a list of presuppositions that come into operation whenever we're confronted with a man whose skin is black. It varies from person to person, but when I come up against a man whose skin is black, my first reaction always was, poor man. I'm on his side. I want to have a poor man that his skin is black. How glad I am that I was not born black. How well he bears it, and what a cross it is. Of course, I always say, there's nothing wrong with being black, it's just being black in this society. But, because I know all men are equal, but still, the fundamental reaction when I would meet a black man is one of pity. How dehumanizing. How racist. Then I think, of course, I automatically presuppose how disadvantaged he is. I assume, without his having opened his mouth, that he will be educationally and culturally disadvantaged. And of course, it's our fault. I know that. See, I'm not blaming him for it. I expect him to have an accent that isn't quite right. I expect his vocabulary and his grammar to be full of quirks. And I expect his style of dress to be a little peculiar, and you know, he'll do some things that we just don't do, but that's because of his disadvantages. But notice he hasn't said a word yet. But I know these things of him. And I'm on his side, mind you. But we think how wonderful it is. Then he opens his mouth and he speaks beautiful English with an Oxford accent, maybe. And we say how wonderful that he does so well despite his disadvantages. Have you ever talked to a Negro for a while and then gone away with the feeling of pride that you could communicate with him? Pride that you could sense his humanity through all that separates you and him, and how good it is of you to be so white and so liberal and so humane. Do you know the feeling? How noble it is of me to be kind to Negroes. Why can't all men be kind to Negroes and give them what they want, which is merely an equal chance? And the black militant says, white people are patronizing. They're condescending. They deny it verbally, but subconsciously, they do feel that white is better. And the black militant says, we don't want to be patronized. Do you want to be patronized? Then the second thing I want you to reflect on is the brainwash. For 350 years, blacks in America have been told, as I said, that they bear the curse of Ham. And they've come to believe that their skin is an ugly color. And instead, they buy whiteners. They try to straighten their kinky hair. Moreover, they have no history. We've taken their history away from them. Up here, boy, you're aware of that. How many times don't you hear references to our Norwegian heritage? Sometimes you get the impression everybody up here is Norwegian. Or our Swedish heritage or anything. But the black man has no heritage. It was taken away from him. He doesn't know his history. He lost his name. When his ancestors were brought over in the slave ships, he lost his name, his religion, and his culture. And you say, well, he picked up a better one. Well, but he never was really allowed to call that his own. All that the black man has been able to do is struggle to appropriate Western European history and culture. We have written our history books too, the history books that the Negro students study in grade school and high school. That's changing now, but still, almost every black in this country read his history book out of a book that says Africa didn't exist. Well, Africa existed in the time of the Queen of Sheba, or maybe when Philip hopped in the chariot with the eunuch from Ethiopia. Then it disappeared and was rediscovered in the 19th century when the white man brought culture to Africa and opened the dark continent. Prior to that time, there were just a bunch of black men, some short, some tall. Fascinating, fascinating. Different heights, different thicknesses of lips, weirdest costumes, half naked, interesting customs, a fertile field for anthropologists, but there they were. And then in the 19th century, the white man assumed his burden and brought them into civilization. And this is totally wrong. You know, there were great African civilizations. There were great African kings and empires. This is a funny side of the coin, but there were powerful African chieftains who conducted the raids that brought the other Africans to the coast so that they could be enslaved and shipped to America. You see, it is terribly difficult for a person to have self-confidence when everything he is taught in school, in church, and at home, and the parents are teaching it too, because one of the things the parents have to teach the kid is to be careful. Don't look smart, don't talk smart, don't go to the head of the class, and don't be first in the spelling bee. You may get hurt, and you might even get killed. The parents are inculcating submissiveness, docility, just as a way of staying alive. So when parents and church and school all teach you're nothing, and you gotta be nothing, and your ancestors have never done anything, nothing good has ever come out of blacks. We have a few. Jackie Robinson. You know, what does it do to a person? All the standards in this country are white. They're enforced by whites for the special benefit of whites. And now the black militants are saying, take your ideas of white beauty, truth, and goodness and shut them. We're not interested. Black is beautiful. You never let us know it. You robbed us of our history, our traditions, our culture, our language, even our names. You took away our pride, our self-respect, our self-love, and you substituted emptiness and shame and self-contempt. We're not even going to associate with you any longer. We're not going to listen to you. You're dangerous. You destroy us. There's nothing we can learn from you. Your ideals have to be desecrated for us to become free. We can't accept your values. We first have to recover ourselves. To do that, we're going to have to learn, say the black militants, to hate you and everything you stand for, so that maybe we can overcome the self-hatred that you've ingrained in us for 350 years. And the third and last thing I want you to think about. Many white people will come back to the black militants and say, but look, won't you at least work with those of us whites who share your aspirations? Won't you let us work with you? There are some whites, you know, who sympathize with your struggle, who want you to obtain full justice and human dignity. Are you going to treat us just like you treat George Wallace? A black militant may well come back with, nope, we don't want your help. Yep, we're going to treat you just like we treat George Wallace. Because you can't share our aspirations fully enough. You can't really sympathize with our struggle. You don't really want to obtain full justice and human dignity for black people at any cost. And that's the key. At any cost. And we don't. I don't. There are other goods in life. So you see, because we're white, we are always capable of betrayal at the crucial moment. And the black man in this country has seen a lot of betrayal by whites. The 1964 Democratic Convention may have been the straw that broke the camel's back when the Mississippi Freedom Party was not seated by the Democratic Convention. Why? Because the whites said, all of the white liberals who were in control of the party machinery said, well, yeah, you're right, the primary was not open, it was discriminatory, but you see, we've got an election coming up and we need to elect our candidate and we can't split the party, and if we seated this black delegation, we'd lose Mississippi and Alabama and South Carolina, and who knows how many, we'd probably lose all the southern states and some of the border states too, and antagonize a lot. So, you know, politics is the art of the possible, and so we'll come up with a little compromise solution here. Well, I mean, that was kind of the final proof to many black people that coalition was a myth. Coalition with whites was a myth, even with the white liberals, because when the chips were down, the white liberal would always say, we got to be realistic. And the black man is saying, freedom now. Freedom at any cost. Life isn't worth continuing if we don't get it. I know a bunch of black militants who I believe, they say they are, and I really believe them, listening to them and seeing what they do, who are willing to lay down their lives for the cause. They have, it seems to me, many of them thrown their lives away already. Throwing their lives away in the sense in which we talk about making something out of one's life. We white people just aren't capable of doing that. Only the black man in this society has so little to lose that he's capable of the sacrifices which will be called for in the coming struggle. Well, this is a bitter pill for integrationists to swallow, and tragically, it's a secret joy for segregationists. But is the militant suspicion of the white liberal justified? Let me ask you, what happens when blacks move into your neighborhood? What happens when black children with educational deficiencies become numerically prominent in your children's school? You know, it's wonderful to say, I believe in integration, and I like integration, and I think an integrated community is better than a segregated community, and I think an integrated school is better, because I want my children to meet great variety of people. I don't want them to grow up thinking that everybody in the world looks like a white Texan. I want them to realize there are other, I like, you know, and that's all fine. But what do you say when there get to be so many blacks in your school, say 40%, 50%, and they have not had as good an education as the white kids have had? They are deficient. They're dragging down the standards of the school. Your children are going to get a poorer education because they're in that school and because that school is changing color. And then you say, I believe in integration, but I have to be concerned about my children. And you move. What happens to you when supporting black demands means alienating some powerful white groups with favors to dispense? Politically, the black man has always been dispensable in this country. And I think it's true, some of them claim, that the political gains of the blacks have been achieved when the whites fell out among themselves, as in the Civil War. And when we got back together, as in Reconstruction, the black was again submerged. He gets sacrificed whenever white interests coalesce once more. Well, the black militants are saying it's time to take care of business, and we'll take care of it ourselves. They say, we're going to get our own thing together. We're going to fight our own battles. We're going to make our own mistakes, and they admit they'll make them. But above all, we're going to acquire power over our own lives. Psychological power, political power, economic power. That's what they want. They say that the black man cannot survive in this society, much less advance, if white men control his religion, his politics, his income, and the police who patrol his ghetto. And this, they say, is what integration really means. Well.
Question.
Yeah. I have no meaningful figure, no. It's small. It's much smaller in some parts of the country than in others. It's much larger on college campuses than anywhere else. They're outside of the, you know, the cow colleges, it's hard to find a non-black militant. I mean, it's hard to find a Negro, if we can use the distinction. A black is someone who would say yay to what I've just said. A Negro is someone who would say, well, we have much to complain about, of course, but I can't go along with it. If you find a person whose skin is very dark, who criticizes the black militants, he's known as a Negro. There are very few Negroes on college campuses today.
Now, another question has to do with the church, and black or Negro who has become one with you, with me, in Christ. Where, as Paul expresses this, there's neither color distinction in any of these, and comes into a redemptive fellowship. Their point of view is entirely different than that of the militant, isn't that right?
I don't know why that should be so.
I think it's quite true.
I don't think it's fair for you to characterize much of what you said under the terms of black militants, unless you define what a black militant is, because I know many Negroes who don't fall in what is the common category of black militants, who are blacks, not Negroes,
okay,
but who are not what many here would consider militant.
Well, all right, now let me confess I cheated. I, of course, started off sounding like I was against the black militants. And I guess it's pretty obvious to you now that I'm not. And I'm not distinguishing between the blacks and the black militants. I'm not. No. I don't know.
And the percentage then is much higher than what you've indicated.
Yes, yeah, right. There's a book called Black Rage, a little paperback written by two black psychiatrists, which you all ought to read. because it describes from a psychological point of view what it means to grow up black in this society. And I think it will give you a conversion experience if you haven't already had one. But this Black Rage is the title. And as the authors point out through the book and at the end again, maybe everybody, every black man isn't yet calling himself black or joining the Black Muslims or SNCC or the Black Panthers or something, but every black man is angry. And he's a potential black man. The message just has to reach him. However, on the question of are even a majority of the Negroes of this country consciously black? I'm not sure they are.
If not, I think it's a very substantial percentage.
I think it's my impression is it's a substantial percentage, but would be a minority. I think the problem, though, that Bob touched on is what is a militant?
Yeah.
For example, Paul, would you classify Jesse Jackson as a militant?
I don't know who he is.
Operation Breadbasket, Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Oh. Well, all right.
In other words, I think you run into very real problems, I think the one problem is that the goals that you specify are legitimate goals. There's some militant organizations that are just old-fashioned gangs, you know, whether they be Italian or German or Swedish or what they would be. Extort, and they're just taking advantage of a situation. The practical problem I face, and I work with a number of these groups, is where do you work with legitimate aims, and where are you giving a benediction to a group that shouldn't be given the benediction by your cooperation with them?
Yeah. Well,
that's a rough practical decision.
Let me say now, so that we don't. I don't think there's a quarrel here. I was talking then about black power, the quest for black power. What does it mean? This is a word that frightens many white people. It's associated with black militants. Black militants want black power. Now, you could confine the term black militant just to the guys who are. Carrying weapons and threatening to use them. I would not want to so confine it, but that's a matter of terms. What I wanted to get across is the growing feeling among the black people of this society that integration has been a false dream, and the sense of disillusionment, and now of renewed energy and determination that has come out of this disillusionment and the new hope. This is what I'm trying to get across, and I'm really doing what Stokely Carmichael said white people should do: get out of the leadership of the black movements, go back to the white communities, and explain what black power means and why black power is good. And I'm gonna make one more speech very briefly now. I'll shut up and let you talk, but. Black power is good because it's the only avenue to the great goal of integration, which is still, in my view, the end, integration. A segregated society is a crummy society. But you cannot have genuine integration among two races unless both have power. That doesn't mean that both are armed. It means that they both have strength, power of being, that they are something, so that they want each other. Just like you can't have integration in a marriage. You can't have a real marriage if one of them has all the power and the other one is just a cipher. A marriage is a blending of two real beings, both of whom exist. And our notion of integration has always been sort of the white society sopping up the Negro when he's become nothing. when he's not white, because you can look at his face and see he isn't, and he's not black either, because he's forsaken everything that blackness means, then we'll take him when he's become nothing. That's non-integration. The black man must achieve psychological, economic, and political power. He must be somebody. And the blacks together must be, so that we white people will say, hey, you're great. We want you. Please integrate with us. Integration in good involved both races saying, we want you, like good marriages do. Okay, now shut up.
You mentioned black race. I've not read that one, but I got a little disturbed about this because I went to a college where the black militants were trying to rise and emulate San Francisco State. I started reading into the problem and found two or three books that helped me considerably on that. Malcolm X, not immediately. But Malcolm X, I would say, is a must for every white person to read.
The autobiography
notice,
of Malcolm X.
Notice the change in Malcolm X when he becomes a man, when he is accorded when he's treated as a man, when he goes over to the Muslims and they treat him as an equal and give him some dignity, and his viewpoint changes. He takes an entirely different attitude then toward the whites. I mean, he doesn't become a white lover, but he realizes that I can't just shoot him down and rape. And black like me, James Griffin, that's real good. I read that 2-3 times before I could swallow it. But I can't remember the author of Souls of Black Folk.
Du Bois.
Oh, yeah. Du Bois. He's got a bad name because in his 90s, why he got completely disillusioned with the country that he fought tooth and toenail to adopt and be adopted by, and he went over to Africa, and he has the name of being a communist. But if you read Souls of Black Folks, I think you'll see.
Soul on Ice, Eldridge Cleaver.
Yeah, it's not as good as Malcolm X, but it's...
Well, it's better literature, actually, but it doesn't give you perhaps...
It's a lot harder.
Shallower,
I thought.
Yeah.
Souls of Black Folk opened up the whole thing because I cried
yeah.
when I read what Du Bois went through.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad you brought up this question of books, because we have to. Every white American who knows how to read has to read some of these books. It really is. It's a conversion experience, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But even so, I'll admit this. You mentioned, I read all these and I thought, boy, there's not a bit of this like that. So we had a lecture, Green Farmer, I don't know if he's in relation to James Farmer or not, but he met with a class and gave us a wonderful presentation on some project going on, Hidden Talent. And, we had a church supper that night. The next week, walked up to the white instructor who had invited Green Farmer, Dr. Goldmark, and I turned to her and I said, we're having a lutefisk dinner Thursday night. If you want a lot of good food, would come. Walked out of the room. It wasn't until after I closed the door that I remembered. You think you don't have any racism, feeling of racism in you, but I didn't turn to Green Farmer and say, you come too.
You couldn't have come to our church.
I know, but I could.
You know what I mean?
Huh?
You knew?
I don't think he could, though.
No. Of course, we like to say no because it's two of us.
I don't imagine anything was said either until afterwards. It surely wasn't.
There would have been nothing said that evening. But it sure would have been on the show the next day.
But just to have someone come from the close neighborhood, we're relocating, of course. They're right there,
you know.
Go over and ask them to come over to the
Lutefisk
Supper. We don't do that.
If you want kind of an encounter on a, won't take you much time, try picking up any of the Peanuts books, those little square books, Happiness Is. One particularly good one is Happiness Is a Sad Song. It's got all kinds of great things that are good for all ages, like happiness is hugging your mom home when you get home from school, happiness is the candy bar hidden in the refrigerator. and just thumb through that whole thing. And when you finish with that, put that down, you're feeling real good, and then pick up Black Misery by Langston Hughes. He took the happiness format, only he changed it into misery format. Misery is hearing your friend call you a name she didn't mean to call you. Misery is calling your friend a name you didn't mean to call her. And you just really see that it's a tremendous tension between these two little books. You think you're just a little insight into how happiness is hard to come by. And misery is much easier to come by.
First question you asked is whether or not we feel that we are a racist society. Whether we feel individually that we are racist. You said to reflect upon it. I assume we've had time to reflect upon that. And I wonder what our response is corporately. Is the church racist? Are we individually racist? I have the thing that troubles me more than anything else, and you hit it on the nose, this feeling of, after having been with a black person, thinking, wasn't I really nice? I treated him just like an equal. And as much as I fit the category, I think in some respects, at least of the white liberal, in everything I say, but there it is. And you can see it, you can feel it. But what you can't do, or at least what I've not been found able to do, is to make it stop. So that that doesn't happen again. It's all unspoken, and it's all, it's hard to accept, but it is a racist reaction.
I think part of this is because we are not integrated, if I may use that word again. We do, most of us, unfortunately, don't have the opportunity day after day, and Holden Village is a good example. Here we are all lily white, of just sitting down and working and talking and doing the normal things with people who happen to have a black skin. One of the other things, and this, I may be hitting on this youth gang thing a little too much, but I think particularly in the city areas, these are groups that have to be reckoned with. And I think there is a danger that we will overreact. I think there is a danger that police are so eager to grab people that they're going to grab people and, as you indicate, frame them. We had an excellent illustration in East St. Louis. I got a phone call from Jamie Brown, who works with on the national youth groups working with gangs. He said, go to East St. Louis. Some of you may remember 5 people killed, magazine salesmen in East St. Louis. They arrested Sweet Jeffries, the leader of the warlords in East St. Louis. He was indicted for murder, was held without bail. I met with the warlords and the Egyptians. They said he was absolutely innocent. Of course, I had no way to make a judgment. Among other things, I said, if he's really innocent, tell his lawyer to ask for a lie detector test. And we got word to the state's attorney that he should, if he asked for one, we felt he should get one. He took it, passed completely. As it turned out, he was identified by a woman on the basis, he's 22 years old then, he was identified on the basis of a picture when he was 16, when he didn't have a growth on his face. It was just very clear the police had just picked the guy up. They wanted him for something anyway. And that town could have just gone up in flames. And I sense the same. Now, I'm not exonerated. The warlords are not a Sunday school class. And nor the other groups in Chicago and East St. Louis. But I think where we can, in constructive ways, work with them, I think we ought to. I think we ought to be very, very careful not to overreact. When they do something wrong, they've got to, you know, the law's got to be the law. But let's make sure that the law doesn't go beyond what the law should go.
And we are, in fact, doing just the reverse, as you say, and telling a grisly story. I just got a letter the other day, told me that the leader of SNCC in Dallas has fled the city, jumped bond and fled the city. This guy is a very mild black militant. He seems to me he's the only one in the SNCC leadership, and he was heading it up, who was willing to do something besides shoot it out. He was a guy committed to education. He was trying to turn the ghetto on to blackness. But in the process, he said things that were insulting to the establishment of Dallas. And the guy was picked up for everything. He's continually being arrested for a left turn signal not operating and taken to jail right away. They finally arrested him. He was participating in a boycott of some supermarkets in the ghetto. And he and his collaborator and other leader, co-leader of SNCC, were indicted on a charge of destroying more than $150 worth of property, I believe. It was $137 worth of groceries. They said they knocked them off the shelf. Over $50 is a felony. He was charged with malicious destruction of property, and he and his colleague were sentenced to 10 years in prison for the destruction of $137 worth of property. And of course, this just, if there's anything that's going to create black militants, this is it. And yet so many good people say, well, these people are counseling rebellion. They're preaching hate. We have to do something. And what we are doing is feeding fuel to the fire.
Exactly. If you don't give them constructive channels, you're just inviting trouble.
Fellows are going to fall in the same category as the Boston Tea Party. The guys that dump the tea in the ocean, the black militants of the day, are going to be the heroes of tomorrow, because they're taking action that is absolutely, in many respects, justified by the treatment that has been afforded by whites in the past 350 years. All these things you said about there have no history or anything like that. There are documented instances now, which the police have made according to, and this is the second half of the instructor line. The British supposedly have documented this, of a slave ship leaving Africa with only children and just enough mothers to keep the kids alive until they were within sight of the shore, and then the mothers were thrown overboard. Now, I know I didn't have anything to do with it, you didn't have anything to do with it, but the whites of America did. And that's, we're sowed the wind and we're going to reap the whirlwind.
Somebody asked, you asked, what can you do to overcome this racism? I don't know whether this will work for everyone, but I haven't ceased being racist, but I've ceased with respect to some blacks because they became black militants. And the funny thing happened. I don't know. Well, I suppose it could easily be explained. But when there was one guy in particular whom I knew quite well and worked with, and he got the message. He was a Negro. He got the message, and he became black. Now, he's not a burner or anything. He's a very, very constructive leader. And, he's approved by all church groups and everything else. But he's now consciously black. And when he became consciously black, and then I had several opportunities to work with him, it became different. All of a sudden, I didn't have all these hang-ups. I wasn't worried about, well, for example, I have the habit of calling people boy. Everybody, how are you, boy? Well, I meet my colleague and faculty. And I got so terribly guilty about this, I would use this with Don. I was thinking, you know, I'm too liberal. I don't call Negroes boys. I would also have been, I wouldn't want to say around, when there are Negroes in the audience, I wouldn't want to refer to Negroes. You know, I had this feeling in class. I'd have a couple of Negroes in the class, and I'd want to say something about the Negroes, and I'd feel like it was almost a dirty word, that I was calling attention to this horrible condition. It's like when somebody has a bad case of acne, you don't talk about acne in their presence. And the students, too, you could see it. You know, you're lecturing, and you say Negro, and you just see those eyes. Did he hear? Did he notice? We said the word. But when the people are blacks, I'll stop using that word, but when they're blacks, it doesn't bother me anymore. So now I expect them to be different now. They're black. They are different. Goody. It's fun. I mean, thank God that we're not all the same. And I was always so nervous that Don wouldn't be like me, that he'd say something that wasn't like white people, you know, and then I would have to sort of apologize in myself for him. And I'm free from that now. But I still have the problem with Negroes. So one thing that I would counsel is try to help your Negro friends become blacks.
there's a current theory that I've heard expressed that you shouldn't try to change your attitude. But this is the wrong approach. What you should try to change is your action. Because if your action is changed, your attitude change will follow. I don't know how valid it is, but I know that there, I think Lee Westlake, who's the director of the black director of the priority program in the LCA, which is an attempt to confront white churches with their racist problem, their racist problem, goes on this theme. And he was lecturing this at this recent convention on this theme. I don't want to change your attitude. It's too hard a thing to do. But if I can get you to act as though you should act, your attitude will then change. And what I mentioned earlier doesn't affect my action. It's just enough there that it's there that tells me that there's something wrong still deep inside. Because if there weren't something, I wouldn't have this feeling. But the question we might direct is, to what extent can the church, it's such a bleak picture, to what extent can the church and church people have an effect? It's very simple. The answer is very simple, really, but we can't do it. We cannot say to the black, you are right, you have been mistreated, we are prejudiced, we're going to change our action, we're going to admit you to our, you know, neighborhood school, whatever it is. We can't do it.
Well, he was, you know, I'd like to bring you back into this because
I have a feeling here that's very, very important. I appreciate what you said. I think one of our problems is we want to change them, and the Christian point of view should be, let the person be what he is. At the same time as we want him to be as he is, that is, let him be black, and let him live his culture, and so on. So we do have one thing in common, as I see it, and that's Christ. And when we use the term Christian love, I think that's thrown out around a great deal. And I say, well, can I love a Negro? Can I love a militant? Can I, as a Christian, really love them? Can I say, I suppose I would have the same feeling there that I would for anybody here. When do I love you? And my true love comes when I recognize that I can't, but the love of Christ can love through me. And this is where a conversion experience takes place in me, where the love of Christ pours into my heart, and then the attitude has changed, the actions have changed. I think there's an interrelationship with what we just heard here between attitude and action.
But could you suppose there were a fellow Christian, black, whom you love in this way, but he calls you a honky, and he insists on his right to call you a honky, what would you say to him?
I think at that point I would have to say, you have the right to call me anything you want.
You wouldn't feel, would you feel it was necessary for you to forgive him because he called you a honky?
I don't know if I'd have that much feeling. I don't think it would offend me in that sense. That is, from as I sit here tonight. Now, actually, I get into the situation, maybe a different reaction would come right away. And if it did, it would mean, therefore, that after I got alone in my devotional life, and there, I would have to come to the place where I would have to react, ask for forgiveness for the wrong attitude I had toward him when he spoke that way.
What worries me a little bit is I'm afraid the Christian church has participated very actively in the emasculation of the black man. And that
I think you're right on that. At the same time, in some cases, they have acted very positively. For instance, I think of two churches in Long Island, St. Albans, Trinity Lutheran, which is now ALC, and also Missouri Synod Church. There they have acted very positively and integrated very well as the blacks moved in. And the results have been very positive in both those congregations. At the same time, as it was positive, there were the negative overtones where many of the whites moved out, you see, and so on. But at the same time, they became very live churches which were integrated. And I think that something of the love of Christ moved into these situations, which made the difference at the time.
There were six blacks at the National Convention of the ALC in Omaha last October.
Out of how many total?
Out of 1,000 delegates.
This bothers me that we've been very slow to integrate in our churches. We rather moved out instead of integrating and positively working. I think the church could do a whole lot more than that.
Well, that may turn out to be a very good thing for the blacks, though, because you got a big church, big Lutheran church down in Center City. It was once a nice neighborhood where the white people lived, and now that the neighborhood is changing color, and the church, some people say the church should stay and serve its community. But what it serves its community is frequently an opportunity for some Negroes to become bourgeois. I've always had the fear that the one reason Negroes joined the Lutheran Church was because it was a step closer toward being white than the Baptist Church. And, you know, there's a subtle process of what is co-opting at work here. I certainly, I don't want to say neglect them, but I wonder maybe the best thing might not be for our, here's a church, it's on the cornerstone, it says Evangelische Lutherische Kirche. And it's everything in it smells of late 19th century German America. And it's not supposed to, it's hymns, it's chorales. I don't know.
Well, this is, I think, what I was trying to say. If we can somehow let him keep his own culture, let him move in to be what he is without having to become white.
Turn it over to him.
Yeah.
Turn it over.
There's same spiritual in place of Luther's hymn.
Yeah. So.
I don't think that would be the way to do it either, though, because then we would be being ourselves.
I think they ought to have their own church and invite us over.
This is the We They thing on the yeah. We're talking in categories, which shows our mindset. I think.
Well, we act in categories and we think in categories.
Like this situation exists. If you've had the experience of being the only black person in a group of Negro people having fun, you don't belong there.
I don't think you can generalize that easily. You imply that there is a black humor and a white humor, that there are black social customs and white social customs. Now this is in part true, but I can, Paul was saying earlier, there are some blacks who've even converted to whiteism, or however you want to phrase it, who become like whites. Go up to, it's an interesting experience. I've gone to lunch occasionally at the Kaiser Center at Oakland over a period of years. It's a very large restaurant where you pick up your food. The thing that's noticeable this last 6-12 months at the most is the number of blacks in business suits who are now in the restaurant, obviously employed by Kaiser, in positions of responsibility,
black girls, black men, black girls in mod or natural hairdos without, you know, conforming to present style. But where they're not, the other thing that's noticeable is that they are not in groups of blacks and whites. They are integrated groups, obviously enjoying one another's company. Now, this is not everybody, but this, to say that you can't, I worked for a black man for 3 years. He always embarrassed me in one thing. He's a very well-known, able attorney in Berkeley. And the one thing that always embarrassed me, and does to this day, whenever he sees me, he has one of those loud laughs and completely, without inhibition, will wrap his arms around you, and it wouldn't matter if the Pope was there. Now, I can't really, this is the type of person I have difficulty relating to socially in this respect, because it embarrasses me. This is not my thing, my way. But I have other blacks with whom I know who have the same approach as I do. And if I were not concerned about the reaction socially of other people, I have no problem being with them and feeling completely at home. And to categorize and say, you can't have, the blacks have to have their thing and be left alone and they can have it and then they can invite us, I think demonstrates a lack of understanding on our part, like, of what the black man is. You just put him in a, you've got him categorized. You can't do it.
Well, they're demanding this themselves. They
there,
their own.
There, that's not true.
Well,
they
not,
are
not,
not they aren't. Are all blacks demanding the same thing of white society?
Mm-hmm.
Are all blacks participating in the demand of foreman upon white churches? As, was it Randolph? One of the old real old time leaders, I don't know if it was Randolph or Rustin. Mm-hmm. Bayard Rustin, who in effect has just torn foreman apart publicly for his approach. You can't say that all blacks are doing are apart. One organization or one group that's saying to the white community, unless what they're saying is, you accept me as an equal, maybe they're saying that, but they're certainly not saying in one voice, give me this or give me that, the way of monetary.
I think they're saying, accept me. We're going to be ourselves. We love our hair. Black is beautiful, and they're the ones out. I'm for that. Good. I just admire them and respect them, and they just seem taller to me.
Now, you speak of Kaiser Center and seeing the integrated groups. I had mixed troops in the battalion in Texas, El Paso, Texas, for 3 or 4 years. It was pretty well mixed, except for in a highly specialized company, which were all white. As long as the percentage of Negroes were less than, I think, 10 years ago, if I remember the figure correctly, it was 16 or 17%. I could walk into a battalion mess hall or a company mess hall, and I'd see them mixed up, black and white. Yeah. You got 17.5% blacks are here, whites are here, and you've got less than 17%. Black.
No, I will take my daughter's high school, she's just graduated from, and she is attending a high school where the blacks represent over 40% of the group. In fact, it's the one high school the district's concerned with. They want more whites in because there's not enough whites. And she tells me that part of what you say is true, that there are persons who fall within this category. But the thing that we have to remember is that there are others who don't fall within this category. And my example was given in response, in response to a particular statement. My daughter could have a good, normal social relationship. Don't ask me if she dated any blacks. She hasn't. That she's had blacks in parties and so forth. I don't know where we go with that yet. But she can have a normal social relationship with a high school with a certain group of the blacks. There are some you can't deal with. All I'm objecting to is a categorization of all blacks as they.
Yeah, well, but still, I think you're overlooking something here. It is possible for us to root, to be in favor of something for the blacks, and we want the blacks to go a certain amount. What you said about the black who wears the natural, is conscious about being taller and mm-hmm. more, I found that to be so true. And I just have been convinced now that if we are going to solve this festering problem of racism in our society, it's going to be solved by more Negroes, all Negroes, becoming black. I'm convinced of this. So I'm unhappy about what's happening at Kaiser, because I'm afraid that some of the potential leaders, some of the best leaders of the black movement, are being co-opted by the white establishment.
They're getting sucked in.
Yeah, and this is a great fear of many of the blacks too. And on the college campuses, I find it just amazing how many of these black kids insist that when they get their degrees, they're going back to the ghetto. Maybe they won't all go back, but an awful lot of them, I think, really are. And that is part of the explanation for the demand for, you know, courses, black studies programs that equip you to work in the ghetto. They really intend to go back. They say, we're no longer going to go out and make it in the world of Kaiser. We're going to, because that's becoming bourgeois. That's becoming white or Negro. Well, sure. I'm not going to condemn. And I can't condemn a Negro. I can't. I mean, what he's saying is, I've got a chance here to enjoy the things and the opportunities that you white people, middle class white people, have been able to enjoy for a long time. I finally made it. By golly, I'm going to have these benefits. I can't condemn him, but I can still hope that he rejects that option.
You would reject, I assume, King's approach?
No, no.
Now, do you classify King as militant?
He was just almost before this time. Yeah, I don't think I have no evidence that King faced this issue sharply.
I was reading a book, the one that's published since his death.
Yeah.
No.
Why We Can't Wait?
No. He must have done a number since his death. It's Chaos and Community is one of the subtitles, but that is not Chaos or Community.
Where's Go From Here?
That's right. Yeah. Where do we go from here? And he goes into the history in that book, as I recall, and some of his relationship with the black militants, especially as I recall the March in Mississippi, where he had a confrontation with Carmichael and Meredith with regard to how this was going to be handled. The reason I asked about him is that maybe I'm living in the wrong era. I may just be back there, not up where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
But if you read, if you want to read, someone's talking about beautiful language. His sermons, his books are beautifully written and communicated from a Christian standpoint. This is what I've never understood, why we as white Christians never really understood or bought what King was saying, which was based on the very gospel we claim to believe. And this was the great power of man. And that's why I don't think it's, you have to say that everyone has to become black in the sense you're saying in order for it to work. I think that there has to be this within the society, this part of the ferment, and I think there has to be this. But to say that all your Negro, your black potential must adopt this type of an approach towards society doesn't seem to me to be the
But isn't that kind of a flaw of logic that you're accusing of from our part, and you say our part, in categorizing or putting all blacks either with one program or also misunderstanding, and yet you continue
to say we as Christians should have done this way, or we should have adopted King and so on, and we, you're categorizing again for the whole group. I'm sure that there are lots of Christians that bought and that accepted King in full. I know that our congregation has frequently quoted, and we have adopted practically everything that was published and for which King stood. So I guess you're actually doing the same thing by branding all of the Lutheran, Christians, or